problem of decolonization, essentially this is what we have, is there is something that sociologists and historians call the anti-colonial imagination. We Palestinians had some of that before. And the anti-colonial imagination, essentially, during colonization, we people in the Third World and South imagined, were actually in their anti-colonial struggle, trying to imagine a future, a good future, because they attributed all their problems to colonization. Colonization ended, and we entered a new epoch in history. We call it the post-colonial era, and the post-colonial, you know, started seeing post-colonial societies. And why do we call them post-colonial? Essentially because they're not ex-colonial. Post-colonial means that colonization, classical colonization left, but colonization in structure is still exists. So these societies are not independent, really. Economically, the Arab world was integrated, unlike, again, any other nation, into the world economy by force, by a series of wars since 1811. No 10 years passed without a serious, significant European war on a major part of the Arab world to enforce and guarantee the integration of the Arab world in this world order and in the global economy. From 1811, Muhammad Ali in Egypt attempted to unify the Arab world and establish the first nation state. Essentially, the Arabs at that time were at the same footing with Europe. They were recognizing that there is something called nationhood that is being formed. He was destroyed. France, England, and Turkey attacked him at the same time. And the major significant event later that came later was the Arab Revolution after the First World War. It was crushed too. Sykes-Picot came agreement between the French and the English, divided the Arab homeland into the existing countries now, but they were placed under the mandate or colonization, direct colonization, by either France or England. 1952 comes Nasser in Egypt, tries to do the same thing. He was literally crushed. In 1956, 4 years after he was in power, France, England, and Israel attacked him all together at the same point. Now, another attempt, another horizon began to be seen somewhere in Lebanon. The whole world wanted to destroy that experiment as well. So, what we have here, essentially, I want to skip to the next topic. An exercise in the world making, a challenge, and of the existing world order. So, in that sense, if you take Hobsbawm, and if you take all the historians, and you think of it from a sociological background, sociological framework, Islam, like any other religion, can be defined as follows. Islam is Islam, period. I know this is a very tricky situation, or a very tricky definition. But to speak of Islam as good or bad, and generally when you hear something good about Islam from somebody you know, you hate Islam and Muslim, it's very funny. But if this is not how we understand religion in sociology. Is it good or bad? All religion, in this sense, are equal. They're neither good nor bad. And there is a sociological explanation for how we interpret the text, right? The reader is more important than the text. And the writer is death, as Foucault would say. So it doesn't matter what the writer of any text means. What is really important is how the reader perceives the text. But Islam, in this sense, the very differences in idioms, is actually the language, a language that Muslims use to tell their story in this grand scheme of, or grand world order. So the idea of caliphate is an Islamic way, again, a wrong way, to protest the existing structure of the world order. I have more and more and more and more about ISIS, but I want to skip because I have two more topics to cover. But I want to tell you something. One of the most interesting articles that I read about ISIS, because as I said, most people try to say, study what is ISIS. And that's important, but not why ISIS. And he said, the article says, how to not understand ISIS. And how to not understand ISIS is a title you can list almost every single Western study on ISIS. It leads you to not understand ISIS, not to understand ISIS. One basic rule that I wrote about and I actually argued for, you want to understand ISIS really? Read ISIS, what they say. Don't rely on, because if you want to say, think you're going to find an answer in the Quran, a 1400 old document, for a 5-year-old phenomena, you're wrong. There is no answer in the Quran for ISIS. You can't find an answer. Or in the Islamic history. You can't find an answer. The answer is in the world order. You read ISIS's main magazine, and it's published in English, by the way. In the first one, in the first issue, they give an eschatological view that confirms the Western view that these people are crazy. They're waiting for the final battle between the Christians and the Muslims. True. You can find that in the first one. Read the second one, third one. This is the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and it goes on and on. After issue number three, you start reading geopolitics, not religion. So you're not dealing with a bunch of crazies here. Every military expert commented on ISIS military campaigns as being strategically important to their project. They do have all sorts of crazy behavior, right? But the committee that heads ISIS, Committee of 12, had members, are some of their members are some of the most talented military leaders in Iraq, who were in the Iraqi army before it was dissolved by the Americans and allowed them to do this. One example I would show is, this is ISIS money, the currency. I don't know what the exchange rate with the Canadian money. This is the 10 dirhams. And the picture on it is Al-Aqsa Mosque from Jerusalem. That's a strike. That was like a home run to ISIS. I don't know baseball, but I just... Only ISIS in the whole Arab world has Jerusalem. The most important Arab question, Islamic question in the world is Palestine. Only ISIS had it on its money. Although ISIS never attacked Israel, they attacked everyone. They killed more Muslims than anyone. But they know what they're doing. So they had Al-Aqsa Mosque here. Only Jordan had Al-Aqsa Mosque on their 5 dinars. But Jordan had Al-Aqsa on their 5 dinars not because of its political significance. They had it before 1967 when Jerusalem was under their jurisdiction. And it was like a tourist place, like any country would put a tourist, significant tourist place on their currency. ISIS here puts it on their money. It has political significance. That this is central and important to us. Why? Do they care about Jerusalem? Not really. Actually, to them, Palestine means nothing. They are a transnational movement. They don't think in nationalist terms. But they know this will attract people to them and attract members. So they did it. So a careful study of ISIS is needed, but the recognition should be, I will answer more about ISIS if we have questions about the membership and the organization and the structure and the ideology and everything in the history. But I want to go to the second one. So from 1811, the major events that took place, 1811 was the destruction of the Egyptian project to unify the Arab world. This was a project. This is a starting point to understand any event that is happening now in the Arab world. We cannot understand anything if we don't go back to that event. Next, 1916, a second major event. After the First World War, or during the First World War, the French and the English foreign ministers met actually in Russia and agreed to divide, because they understood they're winning the war and they're going to control the Arab world, they agreed to divide the region between them. Palestine was taken over by England, Syria and Lebanon by the French, Iraq by England, and so forth. With that, they drew the map and essentially created what we know today as the Middle East. The same Middle East they created in 1916 is being destroyed now and is being remade. We had two forces, essentially. One was the major force, the first force, the rebels in the Arab world and the people in the Arab world, who understood two things. The Arab world cannot achieve any sort of economic development unless the division of the Arab world is addressed. The question of division is addressed. Because you need the resources and you need the people, and the resources are somewhere and the people in another place. And you need to combine them. Only a unified Arab world can achieve real economic democracy, economic development. To achieve liberal democracy or any sort of really popular participation in a democratic fashion, you need to address that question. So we got stuck with this 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement. And when the Arabs were trying to deal with it, they were struck with colonial Zionism, the colonization of Palestine, that not only made that Middle East that was created in 1916 a reality, but actually reinforced it and threatened the very possibility to imagine an Arab nation. That's why the problem with Israel is not the colonization of the land. Yes, that's important. If the Israelis took over any other part in the Arab world, the implications wouldn't have been as significant as taking over Palestine. That's why the Arabs are convinced that Palestine is an Arab question. And by implication, also, it's a human question. But they were struck with this, that literally made that arrangement that was done in 1916 stronger. That now each country is not challenged by the Arab notion. That's why I said Israel's existence created this rift, kept the Arab world, created this rupture, kept the Arab world in that historical point. No going to the back, and they cannot move forward. They cannot move forward to essentially achieve all the things that the other nations achieved, forming a nationhood. As a matter of fact, we Arabs, when we say we are Arabs, it's a concept to us, not a reality like any other nation, because our land is divided into 22 countries. And interestingly enough, some of our people can go anywhere in the world, but they cannot go to another Arab country. Especially if you're Palestinian, probably you can't go anywhere, really. So the very idea to imagine yourself as an Arab is very actually difficult. That's why Israel is an existential threat to the idea of the Arab nation. When some Arabs say that it's an existential threat. Not that Israel can kill and eliminate 350 million Arabs. They cannot do that. But because the Arab cultural existence was threatened by that. That's really the meaning of what Nakba is. And add to that, we have to deal with the Jewish question. But I want to point out that what most people don't understand, because the Palestinian narrative, as I said, is not heard. And even when Palestinians talk and the Palestinian narrative is addressed, people don't listen. Our voice is not heard, essentially. Why? Because narrative is a representation of power. And we're powerless. Internationally, the most powerful empire in history is against the Palestinians and in supports Israel. So militarily, politically, economically, by every standard, we are powerless. And our narrative, really, despite the fact that it is more accurate in the scholarly, by the scholarly standards, and that's why Arabs and Arab scholars usually, we always make the claim that I'm not going to talk about my people's story, the story of my people. I'm going to tell you the scholarly standards to tell and write history, and I'm going to use it to tell the story of my people, just as a support. Because power, as I said, narrative is a representation of power. So the question of Palestine, for most people, at this point, is a conflict between Palestinians and Israelis. Actually, that's not really the case. The centerpiece of Arab narrative is that the Palestinians have been facing a colonial venture, a colonial enterprise. That's what you call people who come from Europe and go to another place of the world and take over the land and control it. So from the very beginning, people were saying Israel is a colonial entity. Actually, even Jewish and Israeli sociologists and philosophers and scholars were saying the same thing. One of the first was actually a famous French Orientalist, Maxime Rodinson. He's Jewish, and he wrote a book called Israel, a Colonial State. That was in 1967. So, for a long time, there is a consensus that Israel is a colonial venture. I was speaking about that in South Africa, and I was surprised that South African students in Cape Town University were surprised that I call Israel a colonial entity, although they were living under colonialism themselves. Because the media is, the Gulf War did not take place. That's what the media is. Now we know that Israel is not simply, because there is a discipline that developed, it's called comparative colonialism. And comparative colonialism essentially says that there are experiences, colonial experiences, since the 15th century. They have so much in common that we can create a discipline. They call it comparative colonialism. And comparative colonialism, which is a very recent discipline, essentially says Israel is not a colonial venture only. It's a settler colonial venture. What does that mean? The difference is, like, imagine England and India, England colonizing India. That's called metropole colonialism, or the classical form. In settler colonialism, the Europeans would move en masse and settle in that region and try to establish a home that resembles their European home and construct a white identity. Now, with the development of settler colonialism, we know now that Israel is not simply a settler colonial state. And this is very significant. These are the various types that comparative colonialism says we have of settler colonialism. One is called mixed settlements, plantation, ethnic plantation, and pure settlement. I just want to make a distinction, simple distinction between them, because this is not about comparative colonialism. In mixed plantations, in mixed settlements and plantations, this form existed only for a very short period of time, only in Palestine, with the Jewish immigration before 1904, and then disappeared. In both this one and this one, the Europeans or the settlers conquer land and either exploit the labor, like South Africa, so they don't kill the natives, they need the natives. Or import labor, because there is no labor because they already killed them, like in Haiti. With a pure settlement colony like Israel, they conquer both land and labor. So they took over the land, and they started with Jewish products, Jewish markets, Jewish... So the Palestinians didn't even have the chance to be exploited, like South Africa. So when we have the comparison, of course it's very immoral to say this form of colonization is worse. They're all terrible. But they're different, and because they're different, they have different implications. What does that mean? This means that the natives are expelled from the economy. And if you expel a group of people from the economy, you expel them from history. And if you expel them from history, their very existence becomes a barrier to your own development. You have to get rid of them. It's like you're trying to grow something and there is grass or something, you can want to get rid of it. It's in your way. That explains, actually, all the ethnic cleansing, all the massacres, and explains the current Israeli behavior. In other words, I'm sure if we go and ask the Israelis today, survey them, and say, hey, do you agree with ethnic cleansing? If not a majority, a significant part of them would say no. I mean, this is a very basic thing that people would say no to. But that's not really important, because it's built into the structure of their society. When you expel somebody from the economy, you're expelling them from history. And that actually prepares the grounds for all these practices against the Palestinians. You have to get rid of them. Okay, let me just compare this. I have 60 minutes.
Yes,
five
absolutely.
More minutes. Okay. In mixed settlements, the example of Haiti, I'm very fascinated by the Haitian Revolution. And I usually feel terrible when people just talk about the French Revolution, not the Haitian Revolution, as the greatest revolution in history. Not that it's the first successful slave revolt in history that was able to achieve the second independent country in the Western Hemisphere. But also, the revolt entailed changing the world. Essentially because they didn't want abolishing slavery, but they wanted to rule the island. And that meant challenging the principles of the world economy that was based on slavery. Challenging social relations in four continents, in Africa, in Europe, in Latin America, and in the U.S. North America. That's why Thomas Jefferson was very furious and tried to actually supported the French and the Spanish and the English in their attempt to put down the revolution in Haiti. But what happened in Haiti is very significant as a colonization experience, or settler colonial experience. Christopher Columbus first came and arrived at San Salvador. The story says that he arrived, thanked God. That was the first thing he did. Second, he asked about gold immediately. They told him there is a very rich island called Haiti. He went to Haiti. The Spaniards, they were the most advanced of their time. This is from C.L.R. James, The Black Jacobins, an amazing book on the history of the revolution. They annexed the island, called it Hispaniola, and then essentially introduced Christianity, forced labor in mines, murder, rape, blood hunts, strange diseases, artificial famine, essentially artificial because they were destroying certain crops or cultivations to prevent the rebels from surviving. The rebels, they're called Maroons, who ran away, runaway slaves who went to the mountains, and later led the revolution. But these requirements of this European economy led to decline of the population from 1 million almost to 60,000 in a matter of years. Essentially, this is how the natives were eliminated. In order, of course, there was a priest, it's a long story, but recommended importing slaves from Africa as a replacement. And they started, this is how slave trade was introduced to the world, actually, in beginning with Haiti, and they started importing slaves to replace the labor in Haiti. In 1517. So we have an example of conquering the land and importing the labor. In the case of Palestine, I have the numbers for how they conquered the land. I'll have the examples of from the agency, the Jewish agency constitution about preventing employments of Arabs. Until 1948. It was by a matter of rule. But I want to talk about 2 minutes about something actually that is important, and that is cultural Zionism, similar to the world order. That's colonial Zionism as a structure. They conquered the land, they took over the land by force, they conquered labor, kicked out or ejected the Palestinians from the economy and by implication from history. But that needed an ideology, and that's what we call cultural Zionism. Let me read this, or you can read this. The converted Jew remains a Jew. No matter how much he objects to it, Jews and Jews endeavor in vain to obliterate their descent through conversion or intermarriage with Indo-German, Germanic, and Mongolian races. For the Jewish tide is indestructible. Jewish noses cannot be reformed, and the black wavy hair of the Jews will not change through conversion into blonde, nor can its curves be straightened out by constant bombing. Bombing. Well, I associate bombing with Israel. If I came here, and in my classes, really, I hide the name, and I read that, people will say, this is one of the most anti-Semitic statements, right? It is a very terrible anti-Semitic statement. This is from Roman Jerusalem by Moses Hess. One of the most important three pieces of Zionism. To justify, that's not, this is the core one of the core ideas in Zionism, to justify the foundation and the establishment of the state of Israel, because what he's trying to say is, we cannot live with anyone else. And we have to leave Europe. Despite all the, what is called political emancipation in Europe after the French Revolution of 1789, which enabled people to participate in politics. So at the cultural level too, this is actually important, but I want to introduce, these are the three major actually works in Zionism. This is one of them, but I want to talk about the negation of exile. This is the central Zionist concept. This concept shapes the imagination and the worldview of all the Israelis. Negation of the exile basically says, in order to establish the state, we need to also create what they called at that time the new Jew. And the new Jew is a brave Jew, as opposed to the coward Jew that was killed in the Holocaust and did not resist. You would be shocked, because the Israeli newspapers, until the end of the Holocaust, did not even cover the Holocaust except in the back pages. They started taking, you know, considering that after it became politically useful to them, unfortunately, for such a tragedy. But what does the negation of exile mean? The negation of exile means that the Israelis, from the very beginning, started constructing their imaginations, forming their identity as Israelis, as opposed to the diaspora Jews. Because when you define yourself, by implication, you define the other. Right? What does that mean to us? It means that from the very beginning, when they even defined themselves, formed their identity, it wasn't against the Palestinians. That they did not construct their identities with the Palestinian in mind as the other. Why? Because the Palestinians in this grand scheme don't exist. They were expelled from the economy and expelled from history. And even within their imagination, we don't exist. Thus, all the practices from ethnic cleansing to massacres to daily killing today make sense. It's built into the structure of the economy, culture, politics, everywhere. I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this expansive and beautiful contextualization of so many issues. I would like to open the floor for your questions. We have around 30 minutes for questions. So, Amina, please.
Thank you. The tone that you spoke reminds me of Samir Amin and the It's quite refreshing because almost we forgot how to speak on those structures. And maybe the current event requires that we, you know, dust off those books and those ways of thinking. It sounds to, especially, I'm old enough to even know when Somali was a real paradise. But I want to ask you several related questions, especially I want to start with Nasir.
Can we reduce them to one?
Just okay. Because I want to link with denial, modernity to and development to Arabs, and the question of violence, but also in relationship with what is happening today. Because what was very interesting about the time of Nasir is that the time, like the things like the Aswan Dam was built. There was recently, I saw Egyptian engineer, who is an older man now, spoke about the time when the Aswan Dam was built. He was a young man. And he talked about the Soviet gave them, he said, line of credit with 2% interest rate. And when we didn't have enough money, he said, we gave them fruits. So I think I would have hoped that in those moments, like, for instance, the aspect of that, the fact that there was something other than the Anglo-American imperialism, there was at time the kind of, what liberated those countries were socialism. And today, it's not only the Arab reality and the Arab hope that is being crushed.
Right.
There is, in fact, attempt also to crush Russia and treat it like worse than like Russophobia is worse than now anti-Arabism. Like, I happen to love the Russians. I'm learning the language. And I sometimes feel they watch me and I'm kind of like, something is wrong with me.
So, I spoke about similar topics in South Africa, as I said. Mm-hmm. And this is part of my observation, too. Mm-hmm. That when Nasser and Nehru in India and Tito in Yugoslavia formed this third world coalition, essentially it was based on a simple idea that Egypt alone cannot be free, India alone cannot be free, Yugoslavia alone cannot be free, any country in the third world cannot be free, because in the age of grand empires, you have to establish or construct what they called, Nasser literally called it, the historical block. So what Nasser taught me when I read his philosophy of revolution is essentially, hey, safe. You're Palestinian. Imagine yourself as Palestinian. You can never imagine a freedom in the horizon. Because the forces confronting me as a Palestinian are so great, I cannot overcome these forces. Okay, imagine yourself as an Arab. The same thing. So the only way is to imagine them myself, not only as a Palestinian or an Arab or a Muslim, but something even beyond that to get to the historical block. So this is the notion of third worldism here, that we need to establish a historical block. I love Africa. Probably the best time in my life was in Cape Town. But it's not about loving Africa or Latin America or this side. It's an existential issue here for all the people of the South if they don't unite against this Eurocentric world order. Now, what I noticed too is there is a North and the South, and that was the feature of the world at that time. It is still the same feature of the world today. But there is capitalism changed significantly. That today, we have North in the South. We have people in the South who are very rich and live the life of the North because they are the compradors and representatives of the North in the South. And we have South in the North. I come from the United States and I live in Chicago, and I know of neighborhoods that have as high infant mortality rates, as high as some of the most, you know, the poorest areas in the third world. They live in the North, but they're not in the North. They're South in the North. And it is important, really, now that we have to reach to change our idea about this historical block. It's not only people in the third world. Because people in the North, whether in the North or the South, are united. They control everything. from the state apparatus to natural resources, but most significantly, they are unified in their worldview. People of the South, and I usually like to say we people of the South, whether in the North or the South, are really divided. We don't share worldviews. As a matter of fact, we fight amongst each other and we use brutal force against each other that cannot be explained. This is why I can't understand ISIS. The force they're using cannot be explained because they're using it against other people who are oppressed. And I'm not calling for them to use force, that force in the other direction. That's not what I mean. But what I mean is you need a strategy that you understand your enemies and friends. And we're talking about major part of the people in the North now are not living in the North. They are geographically in the North, but socioeconomically they're really suffering what the people in the South are suffering. So we have to think in these terms and think of coalitions and world orders. But I want to add something because really it's really interesting. As I said before, ISIS is a very terrible organization. People, the worst thing, they should go to hell, right? They're terrible. They killed more Muslims than anybody. They killed Arabs. They killed their own people. They kill poor people. They oppress women. They chop people's heads. But I actually can make the argument simply that ISIS violence cannot be really compared to the Western violence in the Middle East, whether people would like to know that or not. Because when we talk about one incident in which ISIS set the Egyptian, the Jordanian pilot on fire, that was a very savage thing to do, really. But let me show you this and end the answer with this. This is, if you go to Baghdad, at the entrance of Al-Amriya shelter. Al-Amriya shelter was essentially a shelter during the war where people, women and children went to hide during the war in 1991. The claim the Americans make essentially is that they have a report that Saddam Hussein was in the shelter. They bombed the shelter with some what they called bunker buster. You know, it's, you use these nice names to romanticize violence, right? Idioms are very significant. And inside, hundreds, the claim goes up even to thousands, of women and children literally were incinerated. Most of them weren't found because this was an underground shelter and it had a ventilation system and the rockets came through the ventilation system. Literally, they were incinerated and disappeared. They couldn't find their bodies because they were really... That sort of violence is also cannot be explained. And the way it is dismissed, the way it is dismissed as a mistake, intelligence mistake, doesn't actually do anything to the victims of this shelter. But what I would want to tell you this is what we noticed in the last group of people who are working on the same topic from different angles, the history, reconstructing and rewriting the history, that part of the economic packages that are imposed and forced on the Arab world lead eventually to the commodification of human life. We already see that in the US. So when the US gave compensation to the victims of September 11, some people received, the 3,000 people who died, some people received 7.2 million because they make so much money, they're rich. They valued their life by 7.2 million. And people who are poor received, like working in a cafeteria or something, received $200,000. That's a commodification of human life. We see the same thing now in the Arab world. It's part of neoliberalism. I mean, if every time you hear neoliberalism, you should run away.
I'm going to take all of the questions at once. Is it right? Because we don't have much time. I thought the gentleman there had a question, or you're fine.
Yeah, well, I was wondering if you could expand. I thought your idea about the impediment to national development in the Arab world. You refer to the state of Israel as being a kind of blockage. If you could expand on that, just explain that a bit.
Next one.
Louder, please.
In relation to Western foreign policy towards the Arab world, I was wondering what do you think it would take for Western leaders to understand this history that you presented to us and understand how that history contributes significantly to what we see today and allow them to possibly re-examine how Western policy decisions towards the Arab world is not the best.
Any more questions? Yes, please.
Hi. Thank you. Mine actually touched on a lot of things. I'll talk to you later, too. the media, all these different pieces. But I think most significantly for me is the language, the interpretation, the domination, and how easy it is for us to put it on this, say, leaders. But how convenient it is for the smaller people, meaning the dominant skin, white. I love the idea when you spoke about justification and rationalization. And the reason I even talked about language, on my way in this afternoon to meet this, I just put on Facebook, it's about time my people, black people, people of color, start coming up and legitimizing their own language. I like the word racecraft. And so, you touched a little bit on...
Well, I'm so sorry.
You can give it on. Sorry.
I liked when you touched on, you know, the way how things came about, the foundation in which countries are built on, and how simply the present population can look at what happened in France and not think of what happened
in Beirut.
And how they justified. And yesterday, in one of for the first time, I used the word white supremacy, and that's like that word. Don't say that. And that's what I see the world order being. I believe the world order is white supremacy, but the white people act like. That word is so tabooed, and we are the imagination. So, yeah.
Any more?
Yes, please. Would your theory apply equally to China when you look at the history in China?
Okay. I have a question, but it's only requiring a comment on your part. Considering the fabrications and misinformation and disinformation that we get from our media here regarding what's happening right now in Syria, with all the news that it is the Syrian regime that is responsible for everything that is happening and for the killing of the people and for the millions of refugees. My question to you, do you think that the U.S. or imperialism or neo-colonialism or neo-imperialism has something to do with actually the, similarly to what they did with Al-Qaeda, have they also something to do with the creation and encouraging of ISIS to go into, you know, the destruction of Syria altogether? Mm-hmm. So if you have time, please comment. Okay. Otherwise, because we don't have much time yet.
Okay, I'm a sociologist, so when I speak of whites and blacks, I speak of them as social forces, not as skin color or as people. And whiteness in this sense is an ideology. It's not us, it's not you or him or her. So when Césaire was addressing this issue, he was talking about that too. He essentially meant that. Okay, as what I meant with the Nakba is this, is that it happened at a specific and a significant historical juncture, and that is when nations were gaining their independence after the Second World War. And I interestingly was looking yesterday at some of the history. I was reading something, and I noticed, like in East Asia, about four or five countries gained their independence at that same year. So what happened is that is the time when people gained their independence from European colonization. And when you gain your independence, you form the nation, you start having all these tools, like stamps, you construct your master narrative, unite the people with one story, one history. Of course, most of it fabricated. But that's what nations do, they lie. And then you build your nation state, right? The political apparatus that represent this nation and the interest or general interest of this nation.
But the Middle East was already pre-fractured.
Exactly. Exactly. And what I'm saying is this, at this point that the Arabs were gaining, some of these Arabs were gaining their independence, Israel's, the formation of Israel at that specific moment, in that specific point, essentially reinforced the division of the Arab world and made the idea, that's why people say Arab-Israeli struggle and they refuse to say Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Because the existence of Israel essentially means the Syrians can never be free, the Egyptians can never be free, the Lebanese can never be free, because, as I said, any scenario you can imagine as a Syrian, Egyptian, to become free, to live in a society with economic development within the context of that area will fail. There is no potential for it. The proof, look at them now. They fail.
I don't understand the cause.
Okay. But essentially, the Arabs' ability to construct the idea of Arabs requires a unification of the land. And the existence of Israel in that specific moment, in that specific time, essentially affirmed the division of Syria and Egypt. That's why in 1959, Egypt and Syria under Nasser were united. But there was a very funny unification, because there was no geographical continuity between them, and eventually failed. One of the reasons, this lack of geographical continuity, because Israel is at that center. And so any attempt to actually make people think as Arabs, just imagine themselves as Arabs, continue to fail, because ideas don't grow like mushrooms. They have a reality, and the reality is distorted with division and with Israel. Until that question of division is addressed, and until the question of Israel is addressed, Arabs will never be able to think of themselves as Arabs. They can say we're Arabs, but if you survey them over time, and research centers have been doing that, we've seen people started to identify themselves in a very strange way. Recently, with a media campaign, as if we need another division, we started hearing about Sunni Arabs and Shia Arabs and Muslim Arabs and Christian Arabs, which is really another obstacle. Really, and that's, this time it's not coming from Israel. This time it's coming from Saudi Arabia. Funding this conception of Muslims or Arabs, that Arabs are Sunni and Shia and stuff like that. So what I'm saying is essentially this. Your ability to form your nation and all the ideas associated with belonging to this nation was obstructed. This succession, past, present, and then eventually moving to the future, was interrupted by the formation of Israel. So the Arabs cannot move forward without addressing this question and without forming their nationhood. Thus, it is significant culturally for the most part. Not that Israel can kill every one of the Arabs. That's the Nakba. History. I was wondering the question on history and whether the Western audience know. I usually make fun of Palestinian commentators who show up on TV, and I sometimes go on TV and I debate some of them, and they say essentially this, that we need to explain our worldviews or our question and our plight to the West. And I agree with that. I'm talking about people. But when it gets to the point that they want to explain what happens to President Obama, right? That the Americans don't know. No, the Americans know. They have some of the most powerful intelligence services in the world. You can't convince me that President Obama doesn't know what is happening in Gaza. 1.5 million people are placed under continuous siege. It's a big prison, essentially. He has enough intelligence services, Department of State, and Pentagon to know every single thing that happens everywhere in the world. I mean, they even know what Merkel does on her cell phone. Every time she makes a phone call, they know what she's saying. And I'm sure they know what every one of us is saying. Even if I'm using BlackBerry. But still, they can tell. So it's not a matter of knowledge. It's a matter of interest and a matter of structure of the world order. And as I said, if the Americans address this question, they will not live the way they do. They live the way they do. If we look at the income per capita anywhere in the world, it cannot be explained. Nobody can explain the high income in Israel in economic terms. No one. As a matter of fact, let me just give you a little one number. Every Israeli received from 1948 to 1967, and after that it increased, $299 annually. $299 annually at that time was so much money, right? How can we comprehend this? The per capita income in Egypt in 1969 was $109. So every Israeli received almost three times the per capita income of Egypt every year as a gift from the West. That's how Israel survives. That's why Israel behaves the way it does. So do they know that? Of course they do. But Israel performs an important function for them, maintaining control of that region under that. So if you look at Israel's income, the tables of income, numbers, it doesn't make sense economically. Most of the economic activities in Israel are a total failure. And I actually can challenge, because this is part of my doctoral dissertation. Every economic activity almost, the pride of Israel in technology, in agriculture. In agriculture from almost 1890 until 2000, I covered this period year by year. In most years, even the returns from agriculture did not cover only the expenses or the cost of irrigation. Now, is Israel the agriculture technologically advanced? It is. As an economic project, it's a disaster. Why they have been doing it for over 100 years? To control the land. So it has a purpose, not economic purpose. It has a function, controlling the land. But economically, it's a total failure. iTech. There is a company, iTech company, that employs, and Israel is proud, like that we have one of the most advanced iTech companies in the world, right? And technology companies in the world. There is a settlement in northern part of Ramallah in the West Bank. It's called Mudayin Elite. And Mudayin Elite essentially is a big settlement inhabited by ultra-Orthodox religious Jews. They employ ultra-Orthodox women at a very low prices, very low wages, these tech companies. And that's how it is possible to have that company in Israel. Why? Simply because the housing is free. The land on which the housing is built is taken from the Palestinians. So, well, add sexism to that, of course, that you think of ultra-Orthodox women in this way, that what they do is not important. Every extra money they bring is an additional help to women. If these companies will pay living wages to their employees, they would leave Israel tomorrow. So only with the occupation of Palestine, these companies can be profitable. Because the land is taken for free, controlled by free, settlements are built by aid from the outside, you can get an apartment or a house for free in that settlement, and you get protection too, and so welfare services. So that made it possible for some women to be employed in this company at very low wages. We can't explain their economy in rational terms then. That's why it is a colonial entity. I don't know why I have France here. The question on France.
That's probably me.
Yeah.
A little bit about France, yeah. No, I was just speaking basically about everything you spoke about was just amazing for me. The truth about, I'd like to speak a little bit, okay, let's make it real tiny, okay? How about the World Banks, how they play a big part in reforms, like in Africa. I did not know this, that for France to give some African countries their freedom, or you know, they still had to pay colonial tax still today. And when you broke down the definition of post-colonialism and colonialism, I think it's important because I think as a student here, I feel like I'm being misled, not necessarily on purpose, but understanding what these terms are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me just, I know I'm over time now, but yeah. Just 2 minutes on Syria, because this is a very significant issue. I probably didn't ever see the example, anything that is applied to the example that we started with, this one. The role of the media. What essentially happened is John Baudrillard say that the war is dead. The Second World War was the last war, the last conventional war. After that, we started having a new form of wars, which we call modern wars. And modern warfare essentially takes place for the major part in the media. So the media plays, that's why I started with this. The media, we cannot understand modern warfare without understanding the media and the role of the media in modern warfare. A simple example on what happened in the Arab world, as I said, that they redefined the events in the Arab world from a socioeconomic-based movement into a democracy-seeking movement. And thus, if you define an event and they defined it in the media or redefined it, you can steer it away from its purpose and goals. An example. Al Jazeera announced the fall of Tripoli in Libya 48 hours before actually it took place. This was a very vulgar way, actually, of even using the media. They tried that in many times in Syria to actually get to the soldiers through media so that they would assume that their president either ran away or an assassination attempt took place and he died and there is no reason to resist. But what we know today about Syria is essentially something really that the world doesn't know, because as I said, your narrative is a representation of your power. And unfortunately, the Syrian narrative was not heard. What we heard is the Saudi, Qatari, and Western narratives about what is actually happening in Syria. You could agree, you could disagree with Bashar al-Assad. Actually, it's very difficult to defend any president in the world. And I wouldn't put myself actually in this position anyway. Even if I like a president, I would still oppose the president, because that's the role of the intellectuals. You should oppose maybe because you could make the conditions better. But the characterization that this is a pro-democracy movement, a revolution in the social sense that we know what revolutions is, requires only looking at the composition of the forces on the ground. And the composition of the forces on the ground, the two most powerful groups, armed groups on the ground, are ISIS and another group called Jabhat al-Nusra, or the Nusra Front, which is essentially the armed wing, or Al-Qaeda in Syria. And the third major force in the region, in the area, is the Syrian military. Now, on the other hand, every group in Syria, every armed group in Syria, is supported by a regional force. So we have to understand, or we need an explanation, how can a regime like Saudi Arabia support a pro-democracy movement in Syria? Where women cannot vote, men can't vote. No, but it's ironic that this is, when we hear the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia talking about democracy and supporting groups to achieve democracy. Or Qatar, the same thing. Or the U.S., because we know that the U.S. hasn't been a charity. Every intervention in the world the U.S. was in was achieved for a political purpose, for the interests of the West. So the essentially here is this. I want to say two things. WikiLeaks was a great thing, actually. One of the greatest things that happened. And we have now four documents before us. One comes from 2006, immediately after the 2006 war in Syria, in Lebanon. And essentially entails a letter from the American ambassador in Damascus sent to the Foreign Minister, Department of State, and it entails a detailed plan to destabilize Syria, to force Bashar al-Assad to change his policy. Do they care about Bashar al-Assad? No. What they're interested in is Syria's regional status and Syria's geopolitical value. And the debate on both sides, whether you're pro-Assad or against Assad, seem to miss the point. I don't really care about Assad. I care about Syria's regional status, the geopolitical value of Syria. And what America wants is that Syria has always been, at least, not in the American camp. Sometimes it was really on the other camp, the opposite camp. So they want Syria to be in that camp and restructure and remake the Middle East the way they want. That document is clear. Now we have three other documents. 2006, before the events started, six years almost before the events started. We have three other documents that actually, from the State Department, these three documents come from Snowden this time, not from WikiLeaks. They speak clearly about the reading of the evolution of the events in Syria. From day almost the second or third month, State Department was talking about the establishment of an Islamic Emirate, essentially ISIS, in Syria. And the actions that should be taken, nothing. They were not recommending doing anything because these will be sources to pressure Bashar al-Assad or to change Syria. So they're interested in redirecting Syria's politics and controlling Syria in this way. Now, if you watch the news, you will come up with a narrative. You watch another TV station, they will tell you another narrative. And I would want to tell you this, that this narrative, the narrative that reaches us the most, is essentially that serves the interest and the power of the West. Mm-hmm. Just about 8 months ago, Joe Biden, the Vice President of the U.S., said clearly on TV in Harvard, it was broadcasted live, that he said literally, our allies, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates, provide thousands of tons of weapons to these groups, the armed groups in Syria, and hundreds of millions of dollars. When I read the catalog for how to make a revolution, that wasn't there. You don't go to Saudi Arabia and take money from them or Qatar and weapons and do that. That's not how revolutions happen. So there is so much misinformation about Syria. I'll stop. I'll shut up. Thank you.
Thank you. I know you can go on and we can listen. We all can listen. Sure.
Thank you so much.
So I did not answer your email because I was busy.